This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Roberto Mazza, and for the Middle Eastern Studies series, today my guest is Yoni Fouras. Yoni is the author of Educating Palestine, Teaching and Learning History Under the Mandate, published by Oxford University Press in 2020. Fouras, through the story of education and the teaching of history in Mandate Palestine, Fouras reframes our understanding of the Palestinian and Zionist national movements. The author argues that Palestinian and Hebrew pedagogy could only be truly understood through an analysis of the conscious or unconscious dialogue between themselves. The conflict over Palestine, the study shows, shaped the way Arabs and Zionists fought, taught, and wrote about their past. We will hear about the story of the land of Canaan, for instance. British rule over Palestine promised the Jews a national home, but had no viable policy towards the Palestinians and established an educational system that lacked a sustainable collective ethos. Nevertheless, Palestinian educators were able to produce a national pedagogy that knew how to work with the British and simultaneously promote an ideology of progress and independence that challenged colonial rule.
But before we delve into all of this, first things first, Yoni, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me for this great podcast, Roberto.
So I was wondering, you know, just to kick off the conversation, can you tell us something about yourself and about the origins of the book?
So, I'm Yoni. I was born and raised in Israel in Kfar Saba. I was brought up by two immigrants from Uruguay, from South America, a small country. I was brought up speaking Spanish and Hebrew, so that's not that unique in Israel, having immigrant parents, but I was, I did grow up in this environment that was not strictly, you know, Israeli, so I did get a sense of other languages and tastes and rhythms, and then the story is very casual, right? It's the high school, and then I went to the army. But I did live for a long time in a commune. I was in like this Zionist socialist youth movement, and I lived in the commune for a few years, and I did education and non-formal education in this youth movement, which was very idealistic, right? And then I left. There was a change ideological change, personal change. I left the movement. I went to the to study at Tel Aviv University, and I discovered the Middle East. Basically, I knew I wanted to study Arabic. I studied Arabic before, but then I turned it into my my life, basically, studying the history of our neighbor, studying the history of, you know, of Palestinians, of Palestine, as an Israeli. I did first degree, second degree, and then I did my PhD in Oxford, which was also an amazing experience because I never lived abroad, and to get to know these people and such an intellectual environment. And during my second degree, I met Ami Ayalon, Professor Ami Ayalon, which brought me into Palestinian history. And I wrote my master thesis on Musa Kadmer Husseini, and it came out as a book. And then I knew that I wanted to focus on Palestinian history, but I shifted from political history and national history into a more nuanced social history. And I chose education and I chose history because I'm an historian. I'm obsessed with history, but also as an educator, or thought of myself as an educator, I thought of history as something very important. And I thought that only if my, you know, only if my, we call it chanichim, you know, the youths that I work with would know history, everything will be fine, because history can solve all the problems and challenges that we have. And this manipulation of history, use of history, I wanted to look at it again, now as a scholar, and delve into late Ottoman and Mandate Palestine, and see the role of education and history, more specifically, in the consolidation of these national movements and of the conflict. Another thing is that we meet now. It's a decade after I started doing this. Now I'm, you know, I have three kids. It's a different story. My life is different. Everything has changed. When the book was published, it was COVID. It was a global pandemic. Now we have demonstrations in the streets. I meet this work again, and I think of it differently. I would have written it differently today, and everything has changed. And that's also right. Part of the magic of history, that it constantly challenges you and makes you think, you know, rethink. So this podcast is interesting in that sense as well.
And you're right, you know, the context changes everything, particularly when we look back at our books. And you're right, you know, if I were to go back 15 years ago when I wrote mine, I will probably write it in a very different way. But, you know, it was the product of that moment in time that also was connected to our own personal life. Now, I want to ask you something about the goals of the book. Can you give us a sense of what is that you want to achieve talking about education, and particularly talking about history textbooks?
So the goals are, they're a bit entangled and complicated, right? So I wanted to give a thicker description of Palestinian education system. So there's great work that's been done on this topic, but I wanted it to make it more social and more cultural, and write more about the people that did that were behind this system, educators, students, and also bureaucrats and administrators. Hebrew education, the Zionist movement in general is, you know, got the attention of many, many scholars in Israel, across the world, and it's also a community that was highly literate and wrote its and obsessively wrote about itself all the time. So what I wanted to do is not, you know, to say something very new about the Hebrew education or Hebrew the instruction of history, is to put this history of education in dialogue or non-dialogue with the Palestinians, or, you know, with Palestinian education, to show basically that, first of all, to give my angle on Palestinian education in late Ottoman and Mandate Palestine, and then juxtapose it next to, or with, in dialogue, without the dialogue, with the Hebrew education system. And basically what I want to show, and I hope I I convince the reader is that you cannot think of Palestinian education in Palestine without taking into consideration Hebrew education and everything that means. And you cannot think about Hebrew or Zionist education in Palestine without taking into consideration Palestinian education and Palestinian in general. And I move back and forth in the book, and it was very tiring and complicated to do it because, but that's the task that I chose, right? To go back and forth between the two communities. And some of it is because I'm an Israeli today, and I also move back and forth, right? So that's my personal issue, and I it found itself into the book.
I really like the idea that you don't take issues with the fact that this is a book, this is an academic work, but it's also tied and connected to your personal life. And I think this is very important because it's also very true of many works. Now, let me ask a question about sources. So you work with sources in English, Arabic, Hebrew, and I was wondering if you can tell us, you know, what kind of material you collected and look at, and also if you can place your work within a specific methodological framework.
Yeah, so that's part of the complication, right? Because you talk about these two communities, and they're basically three or maybe four languages, the three being Arabic, Hebrew, and English. So this basically, from the start, it's complicated because and also because you also collect the sources from different places, and also we have a basic problem or issue or challenge with Palestinian sources, which you obviously know very well, is that Palestine still does not exist. There is no sovereign state, and there are no national archives. So you have to pick that up from either Israeli sources or independent or non-formal places in the West Bank, in Israel. So it's much more complicated. So looking back at this project now, after 3 years after it was completed, I think of myself, I hope I'll get back to this, but I think of myself as a hoarder of sources, right? When I started, I wanted to collect everything that was written, everything I could find about education in Palestine. Why? First of all, because it was lost, right? The files of the education department don't exist. They were lost somehow after 48, somehow or not somehow. People are in the diaspora. The villages were ruined. So there's a task here, right? You need to rebuild it. So I was a hoarder because I had a task that I thought that was very meaningful, right? To try to rebuild this system. So I worked wherever there were something about education. I went out, I mean, within the time that I had, I went to archives in Israel, I went to colonial archives in the UK, I went to private archives, I went to interview people, and I wanted to compile it all, and also textbooks that you've mentioned. So all of this was in this complicated attempt to build a cohesive story of what I said before, right? Of a Palestinian national movement, a Zionist movement that are building their own national narrative and using the education system to using the education system to convince the community of, you know, of how right they are and why they are entitled to this and that and so on. And I think I covered the sources issue.
Moving to the chapters, chapter 1 and 2 are giving the readers an overview of education in the late Ottoman era and the roots of educational segregation. Can you summarize for us both chapters?
So chapter 1 tries to tell the story of what happens in the late decades of the 19th century into the 20th century in both Palestinian education and Hebrew education. And we have the bigger story is that more and more Arabs are becoming literate, right? From a small community, an urban elite that has this capacity, right? That can pay for private education and become learned we see more and more people enjoying modern education, either in the missionary schools, which were very important in Bilad al-Sham, or the Ottoman government education that was also becoming wider, but not that much in Palestine. In Palestine, missionary education led the scene, especially in relation to the people that I discuss in the book. And on the other hand, the Hebrew education system. So Jews are not, most Jews, of course, are not in Palestine. But and Zionism starts and then continues also in Europe, specifically Eastern Europe. And chapter one tries to show this development. On the one hand, what's going on in Eastern Europe, and what's happening on the ground in Palestine, and a community that wants to educate its people, a community that starts to imagine its own identity, Arab, modern Ottoman or Ottoman Arab, and later also Palestinian. And all of that finds its way into the education system and also into thoughts and texts that discuss the problem and challenges, and also into pedagogic material and textbooks. For the Jews, it's different because it has, you know, we are talking about a highly literate community that already has textbooks from the late 19th century, and it's imported into the educational scene in Palestine. Chapter two discusses segregation. So another thing that's important that we haven't discussed until now is the fact that, interestingly enough, or surprisingly or not surprisingly, the two education systems grew apart. Right? We have two communities, or more than the two communities, that are not educating their kids together. So I try to understand the segregation, and this is very, very banal, right? Because when you think back, right, of course, every community educates its own people, and that's why it's segregated, and they had two distinct projects. So what I did, I tried to become smart, right? I didn't examine why it was segregated. I showed how the people who fought segregation, how weak they were, and how their efforts were in the margins, and they could not fight basically the segregation as it came, you know, how strong it was. So that's what I tried to do. I showed that people always talked about, you know, the Zionists, we need to teach Arabic. We need to involve the Arabs in our project, not only to convince them that, you know, the Zionist project is so good and it would do so well to them, but also because this could be a joint project. They could be, we could cooperate with the Arabs to build this country, right? But it never succeeded. It never materialized. And until now, Jews and Israelis don't speak Arabic, right? The Jews, they don't speak Arabic. They're not, colloquial Arabic is not instructed in schools, in elementary education, anywhere, I think, and there's very little in secondary education. And similarly, there's challenges in that sense with the Palestinians out of different reasons. But the chapter, it tries to look at the people who thought differently and how this different thought was actually, how it failed, how this imagery, how this vision could not materialize because there was a greater powers at stake.
You mentioned that in your book, you talk about a lot of individuals. And it's true that the book obviously offers the possibility to delve into a number of very interesting and fascinating characters. But I'm curious about two that I personally believe are the most relevant characters in the debate, Khalil al-Sakakini and Eliezer Ben-Yehuda. Can you give us a sense about who are these people and their role in your narrative?
I think Khalil al-Sakakini is, you know, people wrote a lot about Khalil al-Sakakini and his role in Palestinian national movement. He was very active nationally. but he was also a pedagogue, and he was also a very active a pedagogue. He wrote textbooks, and he thought of education. He also visited the United States and saw other, you know, types of education. And before the demise of the Ottoman Empire, he established the Dusturiya School, which, you know, and with Jamil Khalidi. This was a different school, because Sekakini wanted Arab, and it was cross-denominational, and it had Jewish students and Christian students and Muslim students. And Sekakini is prominent because he was a visionary in the sense of education. And he also worked in the Department of Education. He didn't want to work at the Department of Education, but then he resigned when Herbert Samuel was appointed a high commissioner. But when the British came, actually, they saw him as they saw him fit to lead or to be the most, I think, prominent Arab in the education department. He refused. He left. He was supposed to be the principal of the teacher training college, Kulia Al Arabiya in Jerusalem, and he resigned after Herbert Samuel was appointed. And later, I think because of financial issues, he came back to the department and was the inspector of Arabic. And then he established the Nada College, Jerusalem, and so on and so forth. So we have a visionary. We have someone with no like actual formal education, as we see in the West, right? He has no PhD, he has no official accreditation, but he is extremely active in designing his idea of a modern Arab, more modern Palestinian, and he writes textbooks, and he looks at Arabic differently. He wants to liberate education from this rigid, very official, hierarchical notion that was very hegemonic at the time in Arab schools. I think he failed in revolutionizing the system, but his image was very important in the educational scene. Khalid Sekakini was important. I personally think that Ahmad Samet al-Khalidi was more important than him. I think he took what he did not want to do. He did know how to work with the British. He worked very well with Bauman. He worked very, very well with Farrell, the directors of education in the mandate. And he was basically the one who turned the Kulia Al-Arabiya, the most important secondary school in Palestine, into like an Eton or Harrow, a Palestinian Eton or Palestinian Harrow, constructing or establishing this generation of educated Palestinians that were supposed to build the future of Palestine. And the tragedy about the Kulia Al-Arabiya, and perhaps Ahmad Samet al-Khalidi himself, you know, he died a few years after the Nakba. He didn't survive this transformation, right, becoming a refugee. And there were actually blueprints, right? There were programs to turn the Kulia Al-Arabiya into a college, a full college, and he was supposed to lead this, and it all ended in 1948. And now about Eliezer Ben Yehuda, I don't know if you mean Eliezer Ben Yehuda or Baruch Ben Yehuda. Eliezer Ben Yehuda is important because he was very prominent in these, you know, this group of Jews in Jerusalem that wanted to speak Hebrew, to write, and also to write for children in Hebrew, and also even a textbook. You know, he wrote a history textbook in Hebrew, which is very special because there you can see the difference between what was between Baruch Ben Yehuda and Eliezer Ben Yehuda. If you take Eliezer Ben Yehuda's book and how he treats the Arab and Arab history and his relationship with Islam, is very different than what you see later. So Eliezer Ben Yehuda, who lives in Jerusalem, comes from Eastern Europe, I think, comes to Palestine and starts writing and starts talking in Hebrew. And then he writes this book, and this book, for example, he talks about how the Jews are the allies of the Arabs, and how Jews and Arabs work very well together, and how the Golden Age was a shared one. And then when you move to Baruch Ben Yehuda, another Ben Yehuda, who used to be the principal of Gymnasia Herzliya, a very important school in Tel Aviv, you see that was forgotten during the mandate. And the Arabs are not the allies of the Jews, and the Arabs are that ruined the country when they ruled it for so many years, right? And that our return to the country is actually to rebuild what they have ruined. We have two Ben Yehudas, but very different Ben Yehudas, and also different generations, right? Late Ottoman period, we see a different discussion of the Arabs and Islamic history. And during the Mandate, we see a completely different story when it comes to the Arabs and their history, and so on. If I can just add, during the Mandate, we have a new generation of educators who became very influential and prominent during the Mandate. They were younger. They grew up when the Ottoman Empire ceased to exist. People like Darwish al-Miqdadi, people like Mahmoud al-Abidi, people like Nicola Ziyadi. This is not prominent Jerusalemites. These are people from al-Nasri, people from Taibe, people from or Khalil Totah, people from Ramallah, Brizid. They come from the periphery. They come from a middle class or even lower class, and they become the voice of the younger generations in the 1930s and the 1940s, which is what the young people that went to school needed. They needed a new story, and they supplied it. People like Miqdadi, Dawazi, Akram Zaitar, and so on and so forth.
I want to ask you something before delving into chapter four, which I believe is the central chapter, and it's like the richest in terms of a discussion about history textbooks. Moving forward after the introductory chapters, you start talking about education of the national other. Can you speak about this process?
Yes. So first of all, history textbooks, we mentioned this. So first of all, I needed to find these books, right? And what's frustrating is that I found many because there was another PhD written that also discussed this, right? A very good PhD on history instruction in Palestine. But then he found like 10 or 20 textbooks, and then I went and I found like 10 or 20 more. And then I had to read all these textbooks, it was fascinating, but it was a lot of work. And I said I was a hoarder. I refused to finish the PhD without finding everything, right? Tapping my own shoulder that, you know, I found all the textbooks. So we have a lot. They were written between, you have books from the 1920s, you have books from the 1930s, you have books from the 1940s. It's an industry that did not stop. And it was an independent industry because the British, they didn't want to publish the books. They didn't accept the books that were published locally. They didn't support it. So they did it all by themselves. And that's why their quality was compromised. And that's why there are other issues related to the text. For the Jews, it's immense. You have tens of books, of textbooks, and you have, written by also a large community that I tried to write about in the book. And then let's move to the national other, what you asked. The national other, basically what I was interested in, I wanted to see how Palestinians write about Jews, Jewish history, and about Zionism. And I wanted to see how the Zionists write about Islam, Arabs, and Arab history and Islamic history. And at the beginning, also you come with this preconceived notion that you know what you're going to find. And some of it you do find what you want. And sometimes you find what you want because that's what you're looking for, right? But I was also surprised. For example, I was surprised to see the late Ottoman texts writing about Jews so favorably in modern Nadawi publications. And I was also surprised to see texts like Eliezer Ben Yehuda's and others writing about the connection with the Arabs and how important it was for the Jews in their history. You see how this new reality, post-World War reality of the land promised to the Jews to establish a national home, the Palestinians doing all they can to have their own national home against this colonial project. And you see how this is, from the very start, is written in the textbooks. In Khalil Tawtah and Omar Salah al-Barghouti, their book, Tarikh Filastin, they write Tarikh Filastin and they say in the beginning, Filastin is artificial.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's a creation it's a non-creation. It has no natural borders. And now let's tell you its history. Are we Shamis? Are we Greater Syria? Are we Palestinians? Are we both? So this is, if you go and read a few hundred pages of this book, it's a masterwork. And it's very complicated. It was the first thing that I did when I started working on this book. And it took me a long time to read it. You see how they work with this reality. It's very anti-British. It's also very anti-Jewish. And it's also anti-Zionist, this book. And at the same time, it's fascinating because they try to set the Zionism or Palestine nationalism is. So that's Khalil Tawtah and Omar Salah al-Barghouti. And then you have Miqdadi and Zu'aytar, our history in stories, right? Trying to describe what an Arab is and how noble the Arabs are. And within that, you would see the depiction of, for example, the Jewish settlement as a colony, as part colonial project. You find that already in the 1930s in Darwish al-Miqdadi and other, in relation to Jewish Hebrew history textbooks, you would see how the Arabs are usually depicted as in a negative way, in one way or the other. But the diaspora in general is depicted negatively, because the project was to show that the Jews can only rule themselves, and the only natural habit is in Islam, and the only way to live it is by ruling themselves. So everything that where the Jews were ruled someplace else, it's negative. The people who rule them are, in a way, negative. And it all serves this project of returning to Palestine, right? We have the return to Palestine, and make all of the rest. So this is very distinctive. When you move from the late Ottoman, you know, the mandate period has a new history. The conflict writes itself into the history. And basically, I think until now, that's dominating narrative of both national movements.
Now, you answered already part of my next question, which is related to chapter 4. And chapter 4 is about history textbooks. So I was wondering if you can give us a taste of a general history of textbooks in Palestine, and perhaps again, pick up a little bit more about what you already said about the Arab and the Hebrew ones. And also I'm interested in this concept that you mentioned in the book, where you talk about the fact that this was a way to encounter the national other. Can you explain a little bit more this idea?
You know, there's this saying, right? That what is nationalism? Nationalism is having your own failed or mistaken story of the past and an enemy. So the enemy is very important. The enemy or the other, right? You built your own identity on what you're not and what you ought to be, and this sort of authenticity that you need to return to. And this is very important in all sorts of nationalisms, right? And basically in all in identity, right? In general, we're two academics. We have the academic habitus and we know what it is, and you know, we know what it's not. So that's very important for our world as well. And it's also important to collectivities and communities in general. So what they're not, right? So the national other is the other that is not part of your community, and how he is different and how you want to become different than he is or similar, and how his presence affects you. And I tried hard to find this presence and how it affected both communities. And it was hard because they didn't talk about it. They didn't have like a dialogue about it, the two. We don't have massive documentation of Arabs meeting Jews and talking about their education systems. We do have a lot of Arabs, of Palestinians writing about how Jews are educating themselves. And we have a lot of Zionist educators writing about how Palestinians are educating themselves. So this is the national other. It's a national other that has no dialogue, but does have a notion, or thinks he has an idea of what's going on in the other community. And it was easier before 1948 because the Arabs were still here, right? The Palestinians were still here. They were not displaced, and they were the majority. So the Zionists see these natives, right? They come to the country, they see a native population. They see the Falah, they see its connection to the land. It's part of the land. They want to become him. They want to leave the office. They want to leave the table. They want to leave the documents and the Luftgeschäft, right? And they want to go back to the soil and become one with the soil. Why? Because they're doing it. And they see them there. And they know that the only way to occupy the country and do it well is through the periphery, getting out of the city, leaving this exilic image that they have, that was false anyway, but that's what they thought about themselves, and go back to becoming natives. So that's the national other, and that's why it's so important, you know, that the Palestinians around them. It's hard to imagine it today, but if you were in Tel Aviv at the time, you had Jaffa, and it was filled with Arabs, and it was a big city, right? And if you'd go south or north or east, you would see them. And they were in predominantly, right, a rural society. And that's what they did. And it was theirs. Palestine was theirs. And part of, you know, curing this diasporic image of Jew was through going out and working the land and becoming, you know, a native. So that's why the Palestinians were so important. For the other side, it was the opposite. The Palestinians, and it had a lot to do with the Jews, but it had a lot to do also with a more general process that was going on in the Middle East, is becoming Effendi, right? What Lucy Rizova writes about, the new Effendia. The Arabs wanted the opposite. They wanted to become modern. And becoming modern was leaving the field and leaving agriculture and becoming an Effendi. This meant to become one with civilization, Hadara, Madani, right? And this was also social mobility. So the mandate is also very volatile in sense of economics, and there are more people demographically and less land. So they needed to go and leave the country. So it's cultural, it's economic, but it's also national. Because Palestine could only be won by educated people. And educated people wear suits, and educated people look to the entire world, and they have, and they know languages, they know English very well. They are educated, and the field is less important. And I show in the book, I show the graduates of Kaduli school with, short, very short hair and wearing sandals and looking very simple. not like the falah, but very modest. And I show the graduates of Qaduri or Najah in Nablus or the graduates of the Kulia al-Arabiya, all wearing suits, all very respected, right? These effendis. So we have two national projects, two education systems that that aspire to be the masters of the land, of an independent country, that lead their students to a sense of national unity, but both do it very differently in the sense of, you know, of where they want to lead their students to. One, to the periphery and to the land, and one, to modernism and their own image of a sophisticated, cosmopolitan person. Graduate, but you also asked about.
I wanted to know a little bit more about, the history of textbooks in Palestine. You talked about obviously the differences between the Arab and the Hebrew ones, but I was just wondering, what are these history textbooks essentially, and how did it work? Their publications, and can you just give us a sense of what they're talking about, really?
So the textbooks usually. So we have a genre of textbooks, and I think where anywhere in the world you would go and look for history textbooks, you basically would find the same thing, right? You would see a history of a nation. You would see it in the far past, and you'll see it has its own historic unity, and then there's a conflict, and then they either win or lose, but what's important is that they have their national essence, right? They have the essence, which is the Ummah, Ummah, right? Same word in Hebrew and Arabic. And when the Ottoman Empire becomes like this educating state, it starts producing its history textbooks. And when the Jews start producing their own Zionist history textbooks, you have these two industries, but they don't operate in a void. The Egyptian state is doing that. The missionaries are doing that. The United Kingdom and British Empire is doing this. And the French are doing this, or the Americans are doing this. So the ambient is, right, you have in the 19th century, you have nations who start to educate their public. So the Palestinian textbook and the Zionist textbook is basically very similar in the sense that it tries to do the same as the French, the American, the Egyptian, and so on and so forth. For the Palestinian one, the Egyptian textbooks were very important. Egypt, it's Umm al-Dunya, it leads the Arab world, and the blueprint or the model of a textbook, and also the stories themselves, and also the language was easy because they, the British brought it with them. It got there under the, Khedive al-Egypt. It was very important. And you see that in Palestinian textbook, the prominence of Egyptian textbooks. For the Hebrew education systems, textbooks, you see the influence of the work of Dubnov, Simon Dubnov, and his, magnum opus on Jewish history, and later other histories. You have prominent historians writing history, and then you see these educators basically summing up ideas and putting them into these books in Palestinian, and generally in the Middle East. For Arabs, for example, you have Ancient Times by Breslin, the Egyptologist, that was translated in 1924, I think, by the AUB, and it was also very important for these writers of textbooks. They took much of it, they copied some of it, and they put it into their textbooks. So what's interesting, what I found that it's interesting, not copying or that the plagiarism, or is how they told a distinctive story, is how when a Palestinian takes an Egyptian story about, for example, the occupation of Palestine under Ibrahim Pasha in the 1830s, they suddenly talk about the revolt against the Egyptians, because this is like a proto-nationalism, right? Because the Palestinian peasant was not a sucker, and he revolted against the Egyptians, and he would also fight the British occupation. So what was interesting about the Palestinian textbook is how these different stories that come either from Beirut or from Cairo become Palestinian. And for Hebrew and Zionist education, it was interesting how the greater stories about the Jews go through a process of Palestinianization, right? They become focused on the land of Israel. They become, everything is about this country and this land, and you can only become a people if you are here. So that's also a shift that we see in the 20th century.
I want to ask you something, a specific topic. Nowadays, when we think about archaeology and ancient past of the land of Israel and Palestine, these are very contested issues. So I was wondering, how did both communities engage with and discuss ancient history, particularly the question about ancient Canaan?
So yeah, that's something that I found in the textbooks. I was surprised to find it was a revelation for me. First of all, also here, we are talking about Christian Europe and its discovery of ancient history, and philologists sitting in universities in Berlin and in London and in Vienna and studying ancient history and looking at the Bible and trying to find historic context in this book, which is not a history book that we now know, right? I mean, some of us. The Jews and the Arabs, they took this discourse, this sort of quasi-scientific discourse about history, and they tried to manipulate it and instrumentalize it for their own national purpose, which is basically what the Germans did and the French did. Everyone did this, right? So we are all doing basically the same. That's another discovery that I can tell you now. Maybe it's not that obvious in the book that what they did was not special. But what was special is how they used it for their own purposes. So Canaan, ancient Canaan, was occupied by the people of Israel that were coming from the desert. So in the Hebrew textbooks, this is the first return, right? They come back from the diaspora, and this is a story worth telling, right? They come back, they conquer the land of Canaan, and they become masters of their own house. For the Palestinians, it's the opposite. The Hebrews are the Jews, right? They're coming back. They're the Zionists now. And they want to, again, to take our land. And they did it before. And in these books that start talking about, right, about ancient Canaan, they start talking about the civilization that the Jews came, the civilization that was already here when the Jews came, right? The Canaanites, that had great cities and a great culture, a very advanced and modern culture, and the Jews came and took it from them. And it was interesting to see how early this story was taken by the Palestinians to warn current day Palestinians, listen, what happened before could happen again unless, right? It's like a message of warning. And for the Jews, for the Zionists, it was clean, right? They came to Canaan before, and then they built their own country, their own state, the state of Judea. And then they built Jerusalem, and they built the temple. It was the beginning of Jewish sovereignty over their country that then was lost. And that's why the Jews, they don't study that much what happened since the Second Temple was demolished, right? Until Zionism came and, you know, with this objective of returning the Jews to the land of Israel. So for both nations, this was an interesting story. What I also found during the Mandate is that the racial issue was also important for both people, although they were targeted for their race, right? The Jews were talking about their Semitism. They borrowed this idea of Semitism and racial affinities, right, with the Canaanites. You can find examples in the books of scholars talking about how their noses resemble the noses of Canaanites, and how this connection actually ties them to the land. And it's interesting because they came here from abroad. They were strangers in this country and they needed a connection. So being Semitic and saying that you were actually racially connected to this place gives you claim over the country and gives you a Kushan over its history, right? Kushan is the land deed in Ottoman and Turkish. And for the Arabs, it was the same because they said also they were Semitic, right? We are part of the Semitic family. And we are actually part of, and this also was a claim to place the Arabs within a greater civilization that gave the world, right, laws, that gave the world scripture, that gave the world industry, that gave the world basically, you know, the ancient civilization, ancient Semitic civilizations that started everything. So for both people, it was being a Semite was important.
I'm going to now cover the last few chapters together, and I have a long question that takes into account the business of teaching history, but also the business of the students. And so, you know, you're talking about, in the end of the book, you also talk about the question of learning history. And so I was wondering if you can give us a sense of, given both communities, the Jewish and the Arabs, so how did the teaching work, but also how was the experience of the students in a classroom?
So we have two distinctively different education systems. First of all, it's everything is it's divided. It's extremely divided. You have the missionary schools, you have the private schools, you have national schools, you have the education department established by the British. The Jews have the different currents in the education systems. The labor, the Mizrahi, the general. They also have Haredim that I don't discuss in the book. So this is just. When we begin to talk about education during the mandate, we need to understand that it's an extremely complex system, okay? So this is the first thing. So most Arabs were educated. Most Arabs were not educated, okay? This is our starting point. We're talking about the minority that would gradually gain elementary education of 4 to 5 years. So this is a community that's predominantly illiterate, and a very small minority would go to secondary education. Most of it is private, it's missionary. Some of it is national, like Najah School in Nablus, like Audat al-Ma'arif in Jerusalem. So that's secondary private national schools. And in the elite secondary, full secondary schools in, like in Jerusalem, Al-Kulliyah Al-Arabiya, or in the later 30s, Al-Amiriyah in Yafa. So, but who controlled this system? So it was headed, the colonial education department established by the British. It was the first time Palestine had its own education system that came after these, the Ministry of Education that was in Istanbul and the education committees of every sanjak, and then every city or town. So we have colonial education department, always run by a British man on the spot. It was Bauman, it was Farrell, and it was Bunsen. These three were heading this colonial system, which started with a problem because it had no horizons, right? The British came and they promised a national home for the Jews, but what about Palestinians? So if they don't have a political project, if they don't have like a future image of what the state should be, so how should their education be? So they have a very, they start working with a big problem as colonial educators. It's a huge problem. And until now, it's still a problem, right? Because how do you educate without a future image? For the Jews, it was very simple. They were independent. They were autonomous. Very little intervention by the British. They could write their own curricula. They could decide what to say to the kids, what to teach them, and what books, and so on and so forth. The Palestinians did not have the know-how. They were not given the know-how. They didn't have the funds, right? It's a rural society, very poor society. They didn't have the infrastructure to establish their own education system. So it was ruled by the British. It had no future image, no horizons. And they start their work with, they start working with this problematic, haphazard beginning, right? And this will remain until 1948. Very little emphasis on being Palestinian or being Arab and Arab pride and national pride, and very little idea and notion of homeland and a present, right? Who are we? What do we want? Where are we going? This is for every, our national education systems, for me, maybe for you as well in Italy. I knew what I was, right? And I knew where I was going and what's my future as a citizen of this country. It was the most important thing for me. I understand it. I understand it now as a parent. You know, I have two boys in the education system, one new boy that will soon enter, and I see how important this story is to them, to their notion of self. The Palestinians were denied of this notion, right? Because the British promised the country to another people, and they didn't have a solution for this. And the Palestinians could not do it by themselves. They didn't. They did it on the margins, right? They had national schools. They had their own pedagogues, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to educate everyone, to collect different taxes, to establish their own. It started to materialize at the end of the mandate. End of the mandate, you have more. The Palestinian civil society is more able and capable to run its own and administer its own education. But the British were very cautious of giving them anything in the general nationwide level. So this is true for all other, administrative posts. And the mandate is that Palestinians were not given the lead. Where were they given the lead? In religion. That was a Mufti, right? They thought, mistakenly thought, that if they would put everything on religion, it would solve the national problem and the issue of self-determination and independence. And we know that was a huge mistake that they did. But they were tied, or at least when you look at the documents of the time, the people, the men on the spot, they thought they were tied. Like Bauman, for example, when he thought he was coming to Palestine for a year or two, then he would leave. He hated the place. Bauman was the architect of the colonial education department. And from the beginning, he said, this could not work. This project is not sustainable. And we need to think of other solutions. And he knew what he was talking about because he wrote the syllabus. And he filled it with Islamic history and, classic history. But there was no present because he was very afraid that he came from Egypt, he came from Iraq, he saw what happened when nationalism woke. So he was very afraid on the one hand, but on the other, he was also frustrated because of the tools that he was given by the British. So one colonial system headed by a Brit, a graduate of Oxford New College, Bauman, and an independent, autonomous Hebrew system, universal, 100% of Jewish kids, or almost 100% of secular Jewish kids, went to these schools. They were literate, they produced a lot of texts, and they were taught a very national, unified curriculum in which, we and us and what we want to do and what we aspire, and this Hebrew project, everyone needs to talk Hebrew and forget about Yiddish and forget about Arabic and forget about all the other languages. And they succeeded. I mean, they succeeded. If you need to re-examine their goals, but for their own for their own goals, they succeeded. They raised a new generation of Hebrew speaking, reading youths, right? And they were ready to fight for what they believe in. So in that sense, they succeeded. Palestinian story, it was not the story. Education was very modestly funded by the government. Only a fraction was given to education. Very little opening of new schools. Secondary education was scarce. Many problems, lack of teachers, and so on and so forth. It's a long story. Yeah.
I have one last question, and it's really based on the epilogue of the book. So at the very end, you tell the story of a librarian asking you to sum up your research. And I was wondering if you can share the answer with us.
Yeah, so first of all, I didn't like her comment, because she said, if you can't summarize in one sentence. So, I mean, our listeners, if you reach this point, you can already notice that I don't know how to sum up anything. I'm very bad at summing up. But if there's only if I can try and look at the project in hindsight, I tried to, first of all, place the Palestinian story of educators and education, and this idea of sociology of Palestinian knowledge, and give it its place in history, right? And the whole idea of teaching history and teaching in general, and the people that did it, and then take it and put it next to the Zionist education and the Zionist history teaching, and see how they interact or don't interact, and how this interaction or non-interact affected what happened afterwards. And it's a history of, you know, it's like Walter Benjamin's Angel of History and this storm of progress, right? It's this, when you look back, you know, I ask my students about modernity, and they like, and they say modernity is computers, modernity is, and when I think of modernity, I think of Auschwitz, right? And we're concluding our interview, but what is progress? What is development? Development is also tragedy. So the way it evolved ended up in tragedy, or theory, you know, of tragedies. So I tried explaining, or I tried to look into this tragedy through education and through the historical narrative.
This was Yoni Fouras, author of Educating Palestine, Teaching and Learning History Under the Mandate, published by Oxford University Press in 2020. Yoni, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening, Roberto, and thank you for inviting me. It was great.